Welcome everybody. Today I'm really happy to have Oscar Lockwood, who is one of the co-founders of Life Landscapes. Life Landscapes, Oscar will tell us a bit more, but it's one of the big three landscaping companies in South Africa. Welcome, Oscar. So the first thing is, just can you give us a little brief history of Life Landscapes, how you came about, what your philosophy is?
Cool. Thanks, Kevin. Life Landscapes was formed in 2004 and came out of a need that we felt that wasn't being fulfilled in the landscaping industry. From the outset, we always wanted to be a green company in a green industry. And we wanted to make sure that we transfer knowledge, which was desperately needed, we felt, in the industry, because the moment you corporatize landscaping, which has been done by and large, you change the knowledge flow. And we were concerned at the time that knowledge would be leaving our industry. So knowledge transfer is important because gardening is dynamic. It changes with the seasons. It changes with fashion. It changes with climate, as we've noticed over the last 10 years.
So one of the things that, in the landscaping industry stretches from the guy in a bucky who comes with his lawnmower to massive people coming in and building landscape architecture, and even within that range of variety of different types of companies. So how do you think that Life Landscapes stands out within the landscaping industry?
So you can roughly divide landscaping into two categories. You can divide it into domestic, which is homeowners, and that's what we would classify traditionally. I don't want to point everybody into that same pot, but certainly traditionally that's your bucky brigade, where you have an individual horticulturist or a person who's got great interest or experience in gardening with some people on the back of his bucky, and that individual goes and builds amazing gardens that we see around Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Durban, and elsewhere in South Africa. The corporate gardening services, which is where we fit into, we're the kind of guys that would go to any CBD or office park area or golf course or hotel, and we put those gardens together. And that's a bit more technical than a domestic garden, because the people you're dealing with don't necessarily have knowledge, whereas you may have knowledge as a husband or a wife or both, and you have an interest in your garden. Traditionally, there's not always that interest that comes from a corporate, but they expect it to look good all the time, but they don't have the knowledge. And that's where we fit into that niche.
And then, but how do you stand out? Because you've got quite a few competitors who are also dealing in that niche.
Sure. I think what's really important about us is our knowledge is, we probably have 300 years of knowledge in our top management in the industry,
for example. So experience is one, experience and knowledge, yeah.
Experience is really important. We've done it all before. We know how to do it. We know how to make a mistake, by the way, which is the first step in trying to correct difficult jobs.
And also, one of the things I noticed about Life Landscapes is that experience is important because you've gone through as an organization and individuals and leadership within that organization through the droughts and floods in terms of our physical environment. Obviously, we'll talk a little bit about climate change. So you've been able to manage within a period where you have no water and in periods where you have too much water and in periods which are just great, because that's what the scale of experience has been able to deliver to your organization.
Absolutely. So there's something that you didn't mention, which is only obvious when somebody tells you about it. With all these high-rise buildings and the advent of smoking not being allowed in the building, we find now that on virtually every single floor or every second floor on a lot of these buildings there is a smoker's balcony, because bosses have got a bit tired of actually watching people go to the ground floor. So now we've had to create spaces for smokers to go and smoke on a balcony, and that requires a garden. That has huge implications on installation, and understanding how we get that soil up there, making sure we look after the garden, making sure that the planters don't leak. So there are all kinds of other challenges that go with new style gardening.
Okay. And Oscar, we've known each other for quite a few years now, but one of the things that has always been which has impressed Karen and I, has always been your sort of commitment to sustainability, carbon emission minimization. As an organization, what are you guys doing about that?
So from day one, it was one of the criteria in setting up the business that we wanted to be a green company in a green industry. Technically, or by inference, just because you're in a green industry doesn't make you a green company. And gardeners traditionally are net carbon consumers. We produce a lot of carbon. We're not consumers, we actually expenditors. We're emitters of carbon. One of the big problems is we have vehicles coming in and out of buildings. We have
lawnmowers
going all day. We've got all kinds of things just going that are just producing carbon. And how do you mitigate reducing that in a positive way which doesn't affect your quality of the work that you're trying to achieve? And that's one of the big challenges of our industry. It's one of the challenges of the world.
So what are you guys doing about that?
You may have seen, first of all, we try to leave machines on site as opposed to taking machines from site to site.
Okay.
As much as possible.
A cost, though?
There's a huge cost to that because a lawnmower, for example, could mow 8 hours a day for 14 or 15 months and then we'd throw it away. Your lawnmower at home mows once a week, probably 40 times a year. And you wonder why we actually cost to actually throw a lawnmower away in 15 or 16 months when you look at your own lawnmower at home and last 5 or 6 years. So these kinds of things are really important for us to make sure.
So the first thing would be minimizing the transportation of equipment from one side to another.
Yep.
Okay. What else are you guys doing?
So one of the other issues is it doesn't make sense to actually take away green waste from a site. And transport it a long distance, and then only to bring it back as a different kind of product in the form of compost 9 months later. It doesn't make sense to do that. So on really large sites, we try to form and encourage our clients to create compost heaps. Now, lots of our clients have got lots of spare space. You only need 2 parking bays for us, and we can create a compost heap that works really, really well. When you start doing that, you open up the doors to start talking about Bokashi and other things that happen within that structure. We improve the garden no end because we're continually adding, as the compost heap fills up, we're continually putting back into the garden a compost medium as opposed to saying once a year we'll bring it in and if you've got budget, we'll allow you can tell us to spend it.
So on-site composting really leads to, I also always, the client paying to get the green waste removed and then paying to bring it back as compost.
It's archaic.
Yeah, it's stupid. But what's interesting about the statement you just made was really about that there's this continual input of organic or compost, which is organic matter, carbon, into the soil, rather than periodic boosts. Do you think that makes a big difference to soil conditions?
It has to make a big difference because you're adding microbes and nutrients to the garden continuously through the season, as opposed to one-off burst. One, two. It also enables you to change the way you think. So, if you're putting back compost into a garden bed, for example, and we've also got mulch that's coming out of this as a byproduct. We automatically start to mulch and feed the bed at the same time. And then we allow microbes in the soil to change their structures. We stop digging. We save on labor. We don't destroy soil structures. And when you start doing that, you start to see a garden change and for the better.
So one of the things, Oscar, which when we first met, Life Landscapes was the first landscaping company that we worked with that actually was positive about adding Bokashi fermented food waste and mixing it with garden waste. First of all, what were your concerns at that time, and what do you think? How's that actually changed, if at all, positive or negative, the compost that Life Landscapes produces now for our common clients?
Okay, so that's really interesting because, like garden waste, green waste as we call it. I classify food waste as just an extension of what happens within that office environment. So if food can be put into food as energy, can be put into a composting system without actually affecting increase in rodent smell and all the other things that go with it. You've got to actually change your whole structure of your compost because you're putting another layer of microbes into that compost. And when you have another layer of microbes in the compost, your breakdown of your compost is faster, your product is better. And fundamentally, we're trying to get the stuff back into the ground as quickly as possible in the safest way as possible.
Why do you think the compost is better with the addition of bokashi fermented food waste?
So if you take food, which has been fed fertilizers in its growing process, and it's got nutrients from whichever source it's got it from, if you take the principle of a lettuce leaf and you eat half and you throw the other half away, the half that you've thrown away has not necessarily got less nutrients in it than the one that you ate. And the one that you ate keeps you walking and talking and sleeping and doing whatever else you do. So you're throwing the energy away into a landfill of a product that actually should be going back into the ground.
Okay, yeah, and one of the, why we like the fermented food waste, we always like to have the bones and the eggshells for the calcium component going into that compost. So your mineral content of that compost has had a massive addition from from basically minerals through the food waste.
So it's not only the minerals, it's the nutrients in general, it's a broad thing. It's the minerals, it's the microbes, it's everything that goes in. And bones is bone meal. You pay a fortune for it when you go to your local nursery to buy bone meal. Why not just put the bones back in the ground?
Yeah.
As long as they've got microbes on them that are busy eating them up and helping them break down.
So, Oscar, I mean, as a leading landscaping company, you know, climate change is obviously what everybody talks about at the moment. What do you sort of see the big challenges to your industry coming through from climate change?
What are you doing to mitigate against those? We've already started that process. I think there's no place in South Africa that hasn't been affected by climate change in the last 5 years. In actual fact, if we were a little bit cleverer at looking back in the hourglass, we would have noticed those changes in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. What's actually happening is that this thing's accelerated so fast because the accumulation of the damage is actually hitting the wall at the moment. And we as a species have got to change the way we think. And in changing the way we think, I think it's going to be food processing and composting is going to be at the forefront of the way we think and the way we do business in future.
Okay, and what impacts are you seeing on a sort of over the past few years that you've really noticed that acceleration has impacted because you guys are managing very extensive, thousands of hectares of landscape space.
Yeah.
So within that, what are you sort of, what would be the dramatic things that you guys have noticed?
So we obviously do gardens every day. We are putting in a lot of gardens around the country. And if you only look at the lists that are coming out of the kind of plant species that are going into those jobs, you'll notice that there's been a dramatic change in the way the landscape architects are thinking. It's a dramatic change driven by the land property owners. So today, the endemic indigenous, and I mean endemic indigenous planting, is becoming much more of and it's not a vogue, I think it's a...
Well, endemic is basically plants you find within a small region.
So,
yeah. Okay, cool.
So, and that all goes on soil structures, basically.
Yeah.
So the plants that come from Johannesburg or the Witwatersrand area, and you can divide Witwatersrand into even smaller zones if you wanted to, that kind of planting is going to become, and is becoming much more common in corporate landscapes. So you will see now lots of felt gardening going in. Mm. And that's not felt gardening where you just scatter some seeds. That's a felt. When you have to garden to make it look good for a corporate environment, you have to physically plant the individual plants and come up with some kind of platen. You would have seen worldwide, prairie gardening is becoming quite a big thing. Well, in South Africa, we don't have prairies, we have felt. So felt gardening for us is the equivalent of prairie gardening worldwide.
So that's interesting. So what you, I mean, if you had to go historically in the 80s to Bishop's Court in Cape Town, and you could go, and then you went to Houghton in Johannesburg, and maybe, I don't know what the upmarket area is in Durban.
Musgrove Road.
Essentially, yeah. You would see the same type of gardens.
Yep.
They would have the same type of flowers, they had the same type of trees, they had the same type of...
Exotic planting.
Yeah, it was exotic planting. So now, what you're seeing as a pattern is that a Durban garden will be very distinctive, tropical, but it'll use endemic plants that are really only mostly found in that region.
Yep.
So that, I mean, I think that's really interesting, except if you live in the Northern Cape, then you need to be a xeriscaper.
Or a xeriscaper is not necessarily an ugly garden. You can xeriscape a garden and create unbelievable...
Explain what is xeriscaping?
Well, xeriscaping is much more rock than plants. Okay. And much more
so what is the right
patterning?
Word? Zero, X-E-R-I,
X-E-R-I, I think it is scaping.
Okay.
So xeriscaping is still landscaping as far as we're concerned. But certainly if you look at, for example, if you took a Highveld garden now and you were putting it together in an environment like... the Rich School or St. Mary's that we've just done some work at now. Your insect, your naturescaping increases no end. So you start to create space now for insects that understand the plants that you planted. They don't understand necessarily some exotic plant that's been planted there. It's not necessarily within their scope as an insect. When you increase your insect load, you increase your bird life. When you increase your bird life, you end up with an environment which is far more conducive to humans living than an environment that doesn't have any animals in it whatsoever.
Okay.
So it's really important. Naturescaping is a continuum of the way you change the way you're gardening. The other important and probably the most important fact is that in going endemic indigenous planting, you are able to reduce your water load on the garden. When you reduce your water load in the garden, we must start to make facilities managers very happy and excited because it's a big cost to them. Boreholes are drying up.
Okay. So the climate change, what you see, is pushing us back to the way we should have gardened historically, rather than doing this sort of European style type of gardens which we've done in the sort of more wealthy areas. Would I be right in saying that?
Absolutely. I think it. We've got the shot hole borer that's hitting some of our urban areas in Johannesburg and Pretoria, Cape Town now, Durban, most of the centres. And it will probably get right the way around the country. If you think about it, if we, in 1876 or 1880 or 1890 or 1900, if we planted olive trees down our major ulterior roads as opposed to plane trees, and whilst I'm not knocking the plane trees whatsoever, they are spectacular trees. All trees are spectacular for that matter. But today, if we put those olive trees down those roads as a planting, we would have a very different look. And that accounts for all the local indigenous trees of every single one of our urban environments. And our bird life and our animal life would be very different. So it's really interesting, you know.
So, Oscar, one of the last sort of couple of questions is, I mean, everybody has a mentor in their life. When you started up as a gardener, who was your mentor? Who's mentored you in your life, and what do you think the key different lessons are from those people?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. I've had lots of mentors, certainly my business partner, Dayton.
So what was the lesson that Dayton, what did you learn from a landscaping point of view from Dayton? We're talking about Dayton Clegg now.
Yeah, so Dayton Clegg was joined me in 1985 when we started our first business. And we've been together ever since. We still run a desk opposite each other. And we look at each other and talk to each other every day.
And the lesson?
And the lesson is certainly about work ethic as opposed to horticulture. Dayton's work ethic is frightening, and his ability to think through a way of doing a job in the most economical way for our clients is fantastic. Patrick Watson was another huge influence in my life. He's the landscape architect.
He's a very, very, very famous landscape architect, Patrick Watson. So why is he so famous? Just remind anybody that has never heard of him.
So Patrick Watson was the... And his probably known best for the Sun City development that he started doing in 1974-75. Patrick's just, his deep knowledge of plants and the insects that relate to those plants and the soils that touch those plants and everything else that relates to a living thing is really amazing.
So what would you say, was he more of an inspiration to you, or did you get any specific, there's always a take home from some of these people you meet. What is your take home?
I never ever don't take an opportunity to speak to Patrick Watson, because every time I speak to him I get a new lesson. So it's amazing. It's inspiration, it's knowledge, it's everything.
Any specific lesson that you think?
So one of my really famous stories from Patrick was the development bank building in Midrand when it was on its own in the middle of nowhere. We planted those trees into a grassland, there's acacia, karoo, and all of the other high felt acacias at that particular time.
Are you talking about when? When was this?
1993, around there. Yeah. Patrick was younger than he is now, and so was I. And we had all these trees that arrived. He just gave me a list of trees that he wanted delivered. And as Patrick always designs things, he does it on the ground. And we started planting these things, and he said, Oscar, you've got to take the acacia karoo and put them in a horseshoe shape. So they must have a center, and it's like an amphitheater. And at the time, I said, what the hell is that happening? Why do we have to do this, Patrick? He said, because that's how they grow in nature. So whilst you won't see it when you look at them in the felt, if you look at them from above, you'll find that they're operating around a termite mound, or they're operating around a soil structure that has changed. And so that's how they grow. And if you want the look to be the same, then that's what you do. It doesn't have to be exactly a circle, but it's a kind of wavy thing. And yeah, and I've always taken that and said, you know what, Oscar, you think you know a lot, but you know nothing. So.
And Oscar, just any final thoughts on, what would be your one thing you would, to the landscaping industry as a whole, what would you say is the one thing that, if you had to be able to influence and change the course of that industry, what would it be?
I think that what's really important is we've got to spread the knowledge. This knowledge that we've been speaking about today is relatively new knowledge. It's really important that we actually make sure that people understand why it's important to plant a felt garden as opposed to a rose garden. It's really important that not only the people who are looking at the felt garden, but the people who are actually planting it and the people that are working with it and the people that are investing in putting their felt garden in, they've got to understand the journey that they're going on and why they're going on it. And that's really, really important. We've got to pull everybody into that journey. That's the gardening side of it. The other side of it is that we've got to pull in naturescaping. We've got to talk about it. We've got to talk about food recycling. We've got to talk about composting. We've got to talk about the way we do things differently. Because what we did over the last 100 years ain't looking good at the moment. And if we don't carry on doing it, the damage that we've done to the world's soils and soil structures in the last 60 years has been astronomical. And we can't carry on that way. So we have to change the way we do business.
Thanks, Oscar. And if anybody wanted to get hold of you, how would they do that?
They can get us on the website, certainly at Life Green Group.
LifeGreenGroup.co.za.
.co.za. Yes, .co.za. Yeah. Our Johannesburg number is 011-959-1000. Happy to talk to anybody who wants to talk about being a better person.
Thanks very much, Oscar. Appreciate your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.